Welcome.
Вітами.
Вітайте.
Добро пожаловать.
Welcome.
Свіки отвіки.
Хуаїн.
Тере тулемост. Deutschland und andere Länder. Mit Anna Lasoncheck. Der erste und einzige Podcast in Deutschland, Österreich und der Schweiz, der sich mit interkultureller Kommunikation beschäftigt, spannende Impulse über fremde Länder liefert, entfernte Kulturen näher bringt und erfolgreiche Menschen mit internationaler Erfahrung interviewt. Heute im Gespräch mit Anna Lasoncheck, Dirk Dirn.
So then, 3 years later, you know, I finished in Brazil and my father's moved on to his next project. We're moved back to the UK. I go to an English school. So I'm back sitting there. I'm in my tweed uniform with my tie. And of course, in the American system, we could wear what we want. So I'm sitting there and it's history class, right? And so we get a test from the history teacher. And he says to us in this test, I've got a question. It says, in your opinion, and then it asks a question. If I recall correctly, it was about World War II. And so I gave my answer. And the following day, we go back to history class, and the guy gave me a zero, or at least for that question, he gave me a zero. And by the way, I was a history fanatic, right? I loved history. So I immediately picked up that paper after 3 years of being taught in this American system. I stormed to the front of the classroom, and I said, teacher, I forget this guy's name. I probably forgot it for a very good reason. I went to the front of the class. I said to him, teacher, this is so unfair. How was this wrong? And he said, well, it's wrong. I said, but you asked me for my opinion. I gave you my opinion. My opinion cannot be wrong. And he said, well, it's not what we spoke about in class. I said, I don't care what we spoke about in class. Is there anything factually incorrect in my answer? He said, no, there isn't. But when we spoke in class, we spoke about that, that, and that. I said, but what are you talking about? I disagree with you. And because I disagree with you, I thought you were asking me my opinion. I gave you my answer. The next thing I know, Anna, I'm by the headmaster. My parents have been called into the school. Right? They sat down there. The headmaster saying, it's not because your son thinks something that we changed the system. And I mean, that was so embarrassing. And my parents, who are, you know, quite strict parents, they were absolutely so upset that they had to come into class. And it was horrible. But that's the thing, you know, you have these different education systems, and you grow up in one system, and then you go to another culture, and there it's completely different. And it's something I learned very, very young. And it's something that really got me interested in different cultures and the way that communication is received in different cultures, because I lived it, I felt it. It was difficult, but again, I was super lucky to have gone through it, I feel.
So were you aware at that time that this was a cultural differences, or did you take it personally?
Hey, I was 15 when that happened in the UK, and yeah, no, that was personal. I, you know, a 15-year-old boy, and I was being told off. I couldn't really put it into perspective. And my parents tried to help me out. You know, they were strict, but to be fair, my father that evening, he took me to a side. He said, hey, don't worry about it, because I thought I was going to be in serious trouble. But you know, at the end of the day, I knew that I didn't like that teacher. And of course, ironically, I didn't pursue, as soon as I was given the option, I didn't pursue history anymore, which is such a shame because I love history. And I never did it at A level. And I thought, you know, I was pretty sure I was going to do history at A level. But no, I had no idea that it was a cultural thing at the time. I knew that different cultures were different. I knew when I lived in Brazil, the Brazilian people were very different from English people, who in turn are very, very different from Americans, who in turn are very different from Belgians or Luxembourgish. So I kind of recognized it innately, but I never really thought about it much. I'd never gave it too much thought until the day that I started studying it at university. And then it kind of all clicked into place.
Yeah, you didn't name it. You just only felt it without being able to put it in words.
Right, right. And I mean... You know, we've had those conversations because I know this is your field of expertise, and we've had those conversations, and you so very eloquently talk about this. But you're absolutely right in all of this. these are lessons worth learning, and especially in the international and multicultural environment that we live in. That's why the job you do is so incredibly important, to get people to understand this.
Yeah, to learn, to not to judge, and that there is no right, no wrong, just different. To feel that we are all human beings in spite of the differences, and we have just different experiences, different historical experience, different geography of the country, and it all influences us, even if it's invisible. Those are the most dangerous and difficult differences, because if there is another law, or in one country you drive on the left, in the other on the right, it's very easy to find it out. You can Google it, but there are lots of things who you can't Google it, and that's mostly the challenge for people who live in different countries or who work internationally.
That's exactly right. Yeah. But you know what? Having said all of that, I still don't like my history teacher. I will never forgive that guy. Yeah. I still believe my opinion was right.
Your intention, you always have a good intention. That's for sure.
Everybody. Well, yeah, that's right.
So looking back, do you have another funny or maybe sad stories you've experienced and you want to share, some cultural shocks or something which you still remember?
Yeah, well, there are really so many. I mean, you know, some of them are good, some of them are bad. You know, I don't drink. I stopped drinking a little while ago, mostly for dietary reasons. I felt that I was gaining too much weight with all the alcohol. But
we have something in common.
there you go, exactly.
Yeah, I don't drink either.
No, so I, you know, and that's great. But then when you go to China, you know, it's you can't do business unless you raise a glass with your partner and have a drink. You know, you down a shot and you turn your glass to show that the glass is empty. And it's a way of building rapport, and it's a way of demonstrating trust in the other person. You know, getting drunk with them is something that you do together, and it builds the relationship. So, you know, and those are really difficult things as well. I spent quite a lot of time in China now, teaching at Dongji University. And a lot of students would take me out and we'd go for dinner. I did a little bit of business there as well. You know, I found out very quickly that I needed to figure out a way around the system. So I was taken to this beautiful, really lovely restaurant. And so we were sitting at this huge round table. And when I say huge, I'm talking, it's about 5 meters wide. And the center of the table was loaded with food, and they have those rotating. And so all the food comes to the center of the table, and you have a small bowl and a small plate in front of you, and you just take from the center of the table. So what they do is they serve these little containers of alcohol, and that's in front of you, right next to a shot glass. And so in order to demonstrate respect, at some point in time, you stand up and you take your little vase of alcohol with you and your shot glass. You pour a shot, and then you raise the glass and you yell out Ganbei, or whatever is relevant at the time. You down your drink and you show an empty glass. You have to turn that glass to show there's nothing else in there. So of course, I figured out very quickly, and I was kind of the guest of honor at this one particular occasion, and everybody wanted to come round and raise glasses with me. And I thought, you know, after one or two of these shots, and I hardly drink anymore. In fact, I don't really drink anymore. After one or two of these shots, I started getting really ill. So I quickly ran to the back room. I said to them, you know, if you excuse me, I have to go to the bathroom. So I quickly ran to the back, and I took a waitress to a side. I said to her, listen, can you please replace this vase of alcohol with water? Because it's clear liquid anyway. She said, sure. And she said, you want me to keep bringing you water? I said, absolutely. That would be amazing. So of course, then everybody comes around to me and they raise a glass and I pour myself what is now water, and nobody realizes this. And so, you know, there I am and I'm downing shots of water and everybody around me is downing these shots. And of course, what I didn't realize is the act of actually getting intoxicated is part of it. So, you know, one of the people I was with says, how is it possible that you hold your drink so well? And everybody around me is getting absolutely paralytic. They're completely drunk. And they keep going and they keep doing it. But of course, because I kind of seem like I'm still okay, you know, they keep coming and they keep challenging and they keep raising a glass. And so at some point I thought, my word, I better start showing that I'm intoxicated. And so there I am sort of stumbling around the room and I'm completely corpus mentis. You know, I have no problem at all. There I am stumbling around the room and kind of holding on to people, doing my best impression of a drunk. But yeah, these are the situations you can get into. You know, it was fun at the time, but looking back, there were a lot of people that were very ill the next day from my class.
Those are stories you can only learn when you are in the country.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. It's you've got to kind of experience it. But I would have loved that somebody would have prepared me for that kind of experience.
Yeah, that's my job. That's in the culture.
Yeah, exactly. Train.
But you are doing a great job helping people to be great in public speaking, not only in TED, but also in business life. So.
Yeah, it's something that I was always interested by. And, you know, the intercultural aspect is really important as well, I feel. But, you know, I feel like there are two different types of presentation style. There are information-driven presentations where, you know, you load PowerPoint slides and everybody's looking at the slides. And I feel that that's not a bad style of presentation. It's just different. You know, it's not the TED style. And the TED style I often label as character-driven presentations. So I think what's important is to understand that there are different types of presenting, of public speaking. And that's what I do now. I talk about this a lot, and I do this at university, of course, at the different universities that I teach at. And I've also started doing that in corporate training. And I find, in fact, in companies, I'm not going to say it's more rewarding, although I guess I just said it, but I think the immediate response is very clear. You know, when I'm with a group of lawyers who need to do public speaking and you show them little things that they need to observe in order to be a better public speaker, and they see themselves, because I typically record people when they do their presentations, when they see how just these little things have made them much better at public speaking, it's really rewarding. You know, they immediately see it. And they're really thankful. And I keep in contact with pretty much everybody that's been on any kind of training that I've given, because it is really important. You know, it's one thing if you know a lot, but it kind of doesn't matter unless you can communicate it. You know, I strongly believe that communication is all about perception. And it's not what you say that counts. It's what people think you said that counts. It's not what you do that counts. It's what people perceive that you've done that counts. So in communication, it really is all about perception. And that's kind of the message that I try and put out there. And then the TED platform, I mean, for me, that's just, you know, coaching these TED speakers, that's something I really do out of love and out of passion for the platform. I think it's incredible to get these amazing speakers on stage to talk. And by the way, you know, just a curiosity, I tend not to choose speakers. I tend to choose ideas. So when you're curating a talk and you're thinking about the kind of people that you want on stage, you know, I get the team together and we all talk about the ideas that we want on stage. And when we have really good ideas, then we go looking for people that are experts in that idea. And typically, not everybody is very good at public speaking, but I don't mind, because I feel like it's possible to coach anybody into giving a really good TED talk. You know, there are established methods, there are established sets of behaviors that allow people, that enable people to give a really good TED talk. And if you teach them the behavior, they can get on stage and they can do really well. But it's very difficult to find people with really good ideas. So, you know, I very often put out a call for speakers, but 99% of those people I'll discard because they're doing it for either for self-promotion or, you know, they're some kind of manner. Maybe they've just written a book and they want to publish, they want to advertise their book. And not saying that that's a bad thing, by the way. There are some amazing, one of my favorite TED Talks, I think, that I've already said today is Susan Cain. She wrote the book, The Power of Silence. For me, reading that book was an absolute revolution. It identified the difference between being an introvert and being shy. And I am somewhat of an introvert, but I've learned not to be shy. And I think that's really, really critical. So it's not that authors are bad TED Talks, not at all. But, you know, you do have to be careful for people that are trying to promote themselves and being commercial for a TED conference. So we try and stay away from those. So it really is all about the idea. And once you have somebody with a really good idea, at that point, it's all about trying to get them to speak really well on stage. And that's something we can help with. That's something personally that I know I can help with. And that's what I do.
Yeah, I could experience the speech as you were preparing. And it's absolutely amazing. And it's a dream for many, many people to be on stage at a TEDx event. And I'm lucky to be invited twice this year to do a TED Talk. But many of, especially trainers, they really dream it on their bucket list to be able to do that. So do you have some advice on how to perform well at the TEDx event?
I think, do I have advice in order to get people onto a TED stage? That's one thing. And I think if it's a bucket list item to do a TED Talk, I think that's fair. You know, even for me, I've never actually given a TED Talk. I'm sure one day I would like to give a TED Talk.
Because you are the organizer and they are not allowed. Otherwise, I experience on stage and I enjoy it so much. You are between the speakers anytime at the beginning or at the end of the speech. And it's wonderful because it creates an atmosphere. So you have a big influence on the event. And
yeah, the MC, the person between the talks, I think they have a really huge responsibility. I think TED Talks are, you know, typically it's a more informal event, and it should be the kind of place where an audience member feels like they can kick off their shoes, they can sit back, they can relax. You know, if they want to say something, they should be able to, not during the TED Talk, but they should be able to feel like they can, that they can ask questions. And that's why we have these intervals where the speakers are walking around. And I think that's really the job of the person, the presenter, to really get the audience excited, to get them to fit, to get them prepared, you know, to have a little bit of humor on stage and just have a bit of fun. You know, that's the idea. I mean, let's be honest, a lot of these events are around 6 hours long. I mean, some of the TED events are 3 days long. You know, there's only so much inspiration you can handle in one go. So it's really important for the person to come on stage between the talks to really entertain and to get people active and ready for the next speaker. So yes, and I really enjoy doing that. I absolutely love doing that. So doing my own TED Talk, I think maybe sometime in the future, but right now I just really enjoy what I'm doing between the speakers. But you asked a question about, you know, preparing if somebody wants to do a TED Talk. I think what I would say to everybody is if you want to do a TED Talk, you know, great, and have that dream. But the way to get on stage is really refine your idea. Have an idea that's worth spreading. I mean, and that's the tagline of TED. It is ideas worth spreading. So if you have a really good idea, then make sure you understand what that idea is, how it can benefit people, and then pitch it to an organizer. You know, there are a lot of organizers. I think last year, over 3,000 TEDx events. So there are a lot of organizers around the world who are always looking for good ideas. I know I am. You know, I'll meet people at a party and somebody will tell me about something they've seen. And I'll immediately think in the back of my mind, hey, I've got a TEDx event coming up. Can you give me the details? And then I'll contact them. So yeah, it's just, if you have an idea and you know it's a really good idea and it's an idea worth spreading, contact an organizer and pitch it to them. And I'm sure they'd be super happy to listen.
Yeah, it's great that you talk about the purpose or the goal somebody is applying to do that. And I remember that I've had it on my list as a goal for a year and somehow it didn't happen. And then I let it go and I stopped doing it for myself, not for marketing, not for publishing, not for being famous or not for anything. I just said, okay, I just don't want it anymore because I started caring what people want and not what I want to share, but what is the biggest impact for people. As this shift happened, then I got 2 invitations. So it's not about the ego and about the speaker, but as you just already told, it's about the idea worth spreading.
Yeah, and the TEDx organizers, especially those that have done it for a little while, they know about this very quickly. You know, there's a very large TEDx community, and a lot of the organizers get together quite frequently. And these are the stories that we tell each other. You know, we very quickly understand that there are people that are out there that having done a TED Talk is something they can put on their profile and they can put it on their website, and they feel like they're commercially going to be better off. But the organizers are always looking out for this. You know, it's not the first time they'll have seen it. So, and we're very, very cautious of it.
And when you are on stage, what would be your advice? What makes a great TED Talk or even performance, generally speaking, public speaking?
It's all about the passion. You know, I recall really well last year we had TEDx Luxembourg City in 2018. And I was coaching all the speakers, and they're all amazing people. And, you know, to be fair, we had CEOs of companies and really, really incredible ideas. But, you know, when I'm coaching sort of the older people, they've done a lot of talks before, and they've been on stage before, and they've, you know, they've stood in front of thousands of people before, and they know what to do, and they know how to sound professional. But of course, all of those types of environments are very different. You know, the TED Talk is a more dynamic, it's a more engaging talk. And so it was funny, you know, I was telling all these guys, come on, you've really got to really, really be enthusiastic and really demonstrate your passion and really, you know, push it out there. Speak louder than you normally would. Have more intonation than you would normally have. And really almost exaggerate when you're talking. And, you know, these guys, they come on stage and by the way, they're all amazing. But I then also said the same thing to a 16-year-old. And this 16-year-old was incredible because he'd started his own coding company. Because we, as a team, we got together and we said, look, you know, we understand that coding is really, really important to the next generation. And so here we came across somebody who set up a company at 16 years old and was teaching kids in Luxembourg City how to code. So I went to talk to this kid and said to him, hey, listen, would you like to do a TED Talk? Oh, yeah, definitely. Wow, amazing. So I said to him, look, come to me and we'll have a chat. We'll talk about your talk and how to structure it, and we'll talk about how you can deliver it. And so I said to him the same thing I said to everybody else. You know, I said, go ahead, and when you're on stage, really exaggerate and really, you know, demonstrate complete passion. And he said, okay, you know, if that's what you say. But he didn't come in with any preconceived ideas. You know, he didn't want to come on stage and act professional, and he didn't want to come on stage and look, you know, sophisticated and elegant. He went on stage and he just ripped into the guy. He's like, guys, and he started off, hello, everybody, my name is, and he really, really pushed it out there. Okay, so now the whole event's over. There were three different newspapers that published articles about our event. Sorry, no, there were many newspaper articles, but in three different articles, they used the same phrase. They said that this kid stole the show. So it really is about the delivery. You know, this is the one guy that came on stage and did not hold back. He went for it. And genuinely, his delivery was amazing. Now, I'm going to be honest with you. I think what he was talking about, I'm not sure I agree. You know, I'm pretty certain I don't. What he was talking about was his opinion about the new generation, the iGen. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know that I really agreed with what he was talking about, but the way he delivered it, wow!
I remember the speech.
Yeah, it was great. Yeah. It was, yeah, exactly. You were there. It was a really, really fantastic speech.
Yeah. So talking about the energy and passion, can you tell us something about the differences in public speaking in different countries, especially in USA, Europe, and Asia? What is appropriate? One country doesn't have to be appropriate in another country.
No, you're absolutely right.
And the
you're
audience sometimes has to do a presentation in another country. So what are your experiences? What would you recommend to be aware of?
Well, so, you know, just a little bit of my experience. So I learned a lot about public speaking in my English schools, my American schools, and I went to university in the UK. And of course, best practice was typically seen as the American way of speaking. So, you know, with that in my back pocket, you know, I went out to Asia for the first time, in fact, to Vietnam. And at one point in time, I taught twice a year at USSH, the University of Social Sciences and Humanities at Vietnam National University. in Ho Chi Minh City, and really great place. And I taught on an MBA program there. And I was telling these guys, you know, hey, get up there and present like the character-driven presentations. And, you know, this is best practice and you really got to deliver this way. And it's about you and not so much about the information. It's about your impact of portraying that information. And I realized there that actually I wasn't right. I was, you know, I was giving what everybody had told me was the right thing. But when I saw these people present, you know, on the whole, it was not natural to them. Now, you bear in mind that this is a culture that when they grow up, they're told to respect their elders. They're told not to make eye contact with their elders because it's perceived as rude. You know, the young people look down an awful lot. And of course, in the United States and England, if you look down, that's considered an inferiority complex. So of course, how dare we, you know, we would never do that. But of course, over there, it's drilled into them from a young age. You know, don't make eye contact with me. That's rude. So you have a whole population of people growing up in certain countries in the world where making eye contact is not the thing. And so, you know, here I was in a class saying, okay, guys, you've got to make eye contact because that's how you engage the people. When in actual fact, it goes against their culture that it's really bad practice. It's bad form. Now, there's an argument to be made that with the globalization and with the way that things are going and, you know, internationalization of the way that we do business, that best practice is almost returning back to the way that we always thought it was. And it's predominantly based on these character-driven presentations. But I don't think it's accurate to say that that's what you have to do in all circumstances. And that's why I did some research in what I call information-driven presentations, where it's not about you as a person, but it's about the effective transmission of your information. And occasionally, the best way of doing that is by using PowerPoint and visuals. And so then the best way of doing that is everybody look at the board and let's go through this. And there, it's very, very important to get incredibly well-structured slides, well-structured visuals. And that's what's really important to an audience. So yes, culturally speaking, it's incredibly important. And you know, there is an argument to suggest that these days things are becoming standardized, but I'd certainly recommend that people don't use this character-driven presentation approach as the be-all and end-all in every culture. It's just not the case.
Okay, because I'm looking at the watch. It's so interesting what you are talking about, but maybe you want to share at the end something personal. You grew up in many, many countries and you moved a lot as a child. And now you are a parent, and obviously Brussels is a very, very international city. Would you like to talk a little bit about the situation nowadays, especially in Brussels, when there are many, many expats and children which grow actually with mostly another children which come not from the same country, but from all over the world? How does it impact your parenting, and what would you like to share from your experience?
Yeah, that's incredibly important. Absolutely. So parenting these days is not straightforward. I don't think it ever was, but yeah, we definitely live in a multicultural area. So in fact, my wife and I used to live in Brussels. We lived in the center of town and really enjoyed it. I'm really a city type person, so I love living in the center of the city. But we decided, you know, we're going to have kids. We don't necessarily want to raise them in an apartment, so let's go and live in a house. So in fact, we bought a house on the outskirts of Brussels. You know, Brussels is incredibly international. It's incredibly multicultural. But when you travel to the outskirts of Brussels, you tend to get to these more Belgian towns. And in the town we live, it's very, very, very Flemish. You know, that it's we're just south of Brussels, but we're still within the Flanders region. And it's a wonderful community, but it really couldn't be more opposite than Brussels. So in fact, where we live is very, very singular cultured.
Ah.
So yeah, it was a little bit shocking. So, and in fact, of course, you know, you have these political parties and the far right and those kinds of parties that are really preying on this idea of being challenged by immigration, which I find that to be a difficult one. I don't believe immigration is a challenge. I think this is something to be embraced. But so, you know, here I am, and I've mentioned so often how lucky I am that I've had this wonderful childhood growing up in so many different countries. Now suddenly I have two daughters, and, you know, I live in a town outside of Brussels, and everybody is pretty much the same culture, and everybody is the same ethnicity, and it's something that I was incredibly aware of. You know, despite best efforts, when I very, very clearly remember one day my daughter came home, my oldest daughter came home, and, you know, she was, I don't know, maybe 4 or 5 years old, if that. And we were driving in Brussels, and my daughter pointed out the window to this little girl, and she said, I don't like that girl. I said, why don't you like that girl? And she said, she's got dark skin. And I said, excuse me? That's simply not possible. I could not believe those words were coming out of a daughter of mine, you know, and I've lived in countries, and some of my best friends living in Brazil were of all sorts of ethnicities, and I have so many Asian friends, and I couldn't believe those words were coming out of my daughter's mouth. So at that point, you know, I came home and I told my wife, and I said, right, this is really terrible, and we've got to do something about it. So we've made a very, very clear decision that every vacation, we're going to do our best to go to different cultures and to different countries. And, you know, and I go and I stay with friends to try and keep the cost down. And, you know, I've been to Qatar a couple of times. I've taken them to Qatar a couple of times. The U.S., I've taken them to China. We do everything we can. We've taken them out to Hawaii. We take them as far as we can. Our plan is to go and live with some friends in Brazil next summer. I just think it's super important. So it's funny, the very first place we went to after that incident happened was Qatar. We went to Doha, and I stayed with a friend of mine, a really good friend of mine, and we went to a water park. And it's really odd, you know, this is the middle of the desert, and you have a water park. And we were walking around this water park, and there, in a single location, you had teenage girls walking around in bikinis, and you had young ladies walking around fully covered from head to toe in the water, right? So yeah. it couldn't have been more different. and so I thought, you know, somebody once said to me, don't address an issue with your kid until they ask. And I figured, okay, you know, if my daughter had those ideas, then she, at some point in time, she's going to ask me, hey, why are people dressed this way? And I sat there and I was waiting and she didn't say anything. And we carried on. We were there for days on end and they didn't say anything. So on the final day, I took them to a shopping mall and we sat down. We had a coffee or my wife and I had a coffee and the kids had something else. And I said to my daughter, hey, honey, what do you think about that lady over there? Look, she's covered from head to toe. In fact, you can't even see her eyes. What do you think about what she's wearing? And she said, oh, can I have another drink? I said, yeah, you can have another drink. But wait, you know, tell me, what do you think about what that lady's wearing? What do you think of her? And she said, well, she's wearing what she's wearing. I said, yeah, I know. Right. But what do you, so is this, do you think this is normal? And she said, well, yeah, why not? And so, you know, we had a long conversation about it. And I said to her, by the way, do you remember when we were driving around Brussels and that happened? And she said, oh, no, I know that was wrong. And no, I didn't mean that. And it's just, I heard this from so-and-so. And yeah, it makes sense. You know, some of the people that my kids go to school with or used to go to school with, they have that belief. And so, you know, I don't believe it's a problem living in a place where there's only one ethnicity or culture, as long as you make a conscious effort with your kids. They're your responsibility. They need to grow up understanding that it is hugely important to be able to work, to be able to live with, to be able to live in harmony with all these different cultures. And it's nothing but a benefit, in my view. It is nothing but a benefit. So, and they need to understand that. And I'm really happy to say that my kids absolutely understand that.
Oh, it's such a beautiful ending. And it's not only about the philosophical thing that we should be tolerant and so on, but also it's really on our own benefit. It broadens our horizons and we are just, we can just see things from many perspectives and it can only make our life richer in this mental meaning. So beautiful.
Absolutely.
Thank you for that.
Absolutely.
So, dear,
Anna, thank you very much.
Yeah, I obviously want people to get the chance to contact you because you've spread a lot of great knowledge. And I already mentioned that you also coach companies for public speaking. And that's why I want people give the opportunity to get to know how they can contact you.
Oh, sure. That's very kind of you. Yes. So I have a website. It's basically my name. So it's dirkdanin.com. And so if you can write it down somewhere, that would be really nice.
Yeah, I will do it.
Lovely. So it's D-I-R-K for Dirk and Danin is D-A-E-N-E-N. So dirkdanin.com. And there you can contact me through the website. You can also see the kinds of things that I'm up to. But if I could certainly ask, if anybody finds themselves in Luxembourg City in December, we're going to be hosting TEDx Luxembourg City Women, which is going to be an amazing event. And then next June,
wow,
we've just had the TEDx Luxembourg City event with 1,200 people. And next June, we're gonna make that even bigger. So they're phenomenal events. And I'd really love to see people there.
Hi, looking forward to it. Do you know the date?
We don't, not yet. So the TEDx Luxembourg City Women event, yes, that's on the 7th of December. It's on a Saturday.
Perfect.
So,
I will put it in my calendar.
Lovely. Yeah. So Anna, you can't miss it. I noticed you missed TEDx Luxembourg City. So that's
yes.
The first TEDx event that I've run that you didn't come to.
That's true.
But you absolutely will not miss this one in December. I guarantee if I have to come and pick you up and drive you there myself, I'll do that.
And that will be great. I'm already looking forward to it.
Fantastic.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your time and for sharing your experience and being able to get to know the background of that event. And yeah.
Well, thanks for the opportunity.
And for
Absolutely.
All of the listeners who think that maybe somebody of your friends or colleagues we'll get some new ideas and we'll love to hear this episode. I very, very appreciate if you share it, if you comment it, and if you put 5 stars on it, so it will help that more people can hear it. Thank you so much, and we will hear each other next week.
Welcome.
Vitame.
Vitajte.
Добро пожаловать.
Welcome.
Sveiki atvykę.
Hwaing.
Tere tulemast.
Deutschland und andere Länder mit Anna Lasoncheck. Der erste und einzige Podcast in Deutschland, Österreich und der Schweiz, der sich mit interkultureller Kommunikation beschäftigt, spannende Impulse über fremde Länder liefert, entfernte Kulturen näher bringt und erfolgreiche Menschen mit internationaler Erfahrung interviewt.